Nicholas Wade is the grandson of Titanic survivor Lawrence Beasley and is the author of several books. He has written the afterword of the book Titanic First Accounts, which is edited and with an introduction by Tim Moulton, which is now part of the Penguin Classics Deluxe Edition series. It's a great pleasure to welcome Nicholas Wade to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
When this was originally done and documented, of having these firsthand accounts of your grandfather and others, what was that like for you to learn what happened?
Well, I suppose I've known about it from a young age, that this was the big event in my grandfather's life. And of course, if he hadn't escaped, I wouldn't be here.
Right.
So I've always been very interested in his book and in his account.
How old were you when you realized the story and then were able, old enough, to put it into a context?
Well, I suppose I must have known it from as young as I can remember, but my grandfather was a somewhat sort of forbidding figure in my early childhood. He was rather withdrawn, and I was always told to be on my best behavior when around him, which of course is very intimidating. And then later, as I sort of read the book more carefully, alas, this was after he died, I came to sort of wonder how he'd beaten the odds of escaping. And if you were a second-class male passenger, your chances of getting off that boat were not very promising. 86% of men in second class drowned. So I often wondered how my grandfather managed to improve the odds against him. And his book is not really very explicit. I mean, he tells you the context of what happened, but not why. And he was standing with a large crowd of men on the port side of the boat, and the rumor went round that all the men were going to be taken off starboard. So everyone crossed over to the other side, except for my grandfather, who stayed where he was. So that was the critical decision he made. And then a few minutes later, he heard a crew member call out from a lifeboat that was going down and was level with the deck below him. And the crew member said, are there any more ladies? And my grandfather leaned over the side of the deck, and the crew member looked up and saw him and said, are there any ladies on your deck? And he said, no. And the crew member said, well, you better jump. So he put his legs over the side of the deck, and he jumped down into the lifeboat. And that's how he got away from the doomed ship. So when he describes this in his book, he says explicitly, this wasn't as a result of any conscious decision. Yet it seems to me that if one sort of decides not to move with the crowd, you must have made a conscious decision of some kind. And the only thing I can think of is that he must have realized that the boat was going down. It had already fired its emergency rockets. Now, lots of the passengers at this stage believed the ship was unsinkable, and they were very reluctant to leave the ship. So the early lifeboats went away half filled. But I think my grandfather had come to a different conclusion, and he'd also known that the crew had taken this very drastic step of separating families, of separating wives from husbands. So, you know, obviously to give the women precedence, but why would you bother to go through such a time-wasting step if in fact you had enough lifeboats? So he may have concluded there are not enough lifeboats, that the men will get shortchanged, and that the most dangerous possible place to be on that ship at that moment was in a crowd of men. So certainly his decision not to go with the crowd sort of improved his odds in that respect, and then this opportunity came up to jump into a lifeboat. And I assume he may not have been so explicit with that calculation, because after all, it was a sort of more reticent age. He might not have liked to sort of spell it out so clearly in his book, even though his place in the lifeboat was not gained at anyone else's expense. So it seems to me his actions were perfectly ethical.
It is stunning to me in reading your grandfather's words that he was able to compose and to think so clearly just hours and days after this tragic event occurred. He was writing on the rescue ship, on the Carpathia, on the way to New York.
Yes, his first, the first thing he wrote was a letter to the New York Times. It was published, I think, just a couple of weeks after, within a couple of weeks of the sinking.
April 29th.
He felt there were many accounts that were then circulating that were incorrect and too sensational. You know, there were stories of people sort of firing revolvers to keep men from rushing the boats. And he saw absolutely no such thing, at least until the moment he was taken off. So he put out he wrote this letter partly to correct these inaccuracies and partly to try and build the case for all the things that needed to be put right to prevent such an accident ever happening again. And then that grew into the book. He was put in touch with Houghton Mifflin, the publisher, and wrote his book very quickly, which is often regarded as a classic account of disaster at sea. It's very clearly written, and as you note, in a very sort of restrained way.
You alluded to this early on in our conversation, but certainly an event like this forever changes a life, and I assume that was the case for him. Did he realize what a fundamental impact it had on him?
I think he must have done. He was he'd become a Christian Science practitioner a couple of years before he set sail on the boat. In fact, he was to meet his brother, who was a Christian scientist in Toronto, but he had bought this ticket on the Titanic. He was certainly deeply into the writings of Mary Baker Eddy, the founder of Christian Science at the time, and he refers in a letter he sent to a Christian Science journal. He attributes his escape to having, in the few minutes after the collision, having read the 93rd Psalm several times over. He doesn't mention any of that in his book, so maybe that was a sort of separate quarter of his mind. But in any case, being of a religious turn of mind, at least at that time, though I think he sort of lost it later in his life, he must indeed have wondered about the workings of Providence that had saved him. But in the rest of his life, I'm not quite sure how it affected him. I mean, he certainly felt his traveling days were over, so he never traveled again. He never left England.
In the book, Titanic First Accounts, a passage that he writes, "Imagine a ship nearly a sixth of a mile long, 75 feet high to the top decks, with four enormous funnels above the decks, and masts again high above the funnels, with her hundreds of portholes, all her saloons and other rooms brilliant with light, and all around her little boats filled with those who until a few hours before had trod her decks and read in her libraries and listened to the music of her band in happy content, and who were now looking up in amazement at the enormous mass above them and rowing away from her because she was sinking." And obviously something that stayed with him forever. And I'm curious as to whether it was similar to a war veteran who would often not speak. It seemed that your grandfather, at least in writing, would communicate his thoughts about what happened.
He did. It must have been a sort of cathartic process for him to write that book. But I don't think he talked about the sinking very much after that. It was as if, you know, he didn't want the event to overwhelm him, and he had to move on. So he'd written this account, and I think he wanted to leave his words exactly as they stood. So he never changed or modified them. And people often would come to him to consult him about various controversies that continued to roll on for many years afterwards, such as the question of whether there was a ship called the Californian that some people thought was close enough to have rescued the survivors, but ignored it sink. So people often came to consult him about that, and he was often consulted about films made about the Titanic. A Night to Remember was a film which I remember he gave some advice on. Now, I think they asked him to try and imitate the screams of the drowning, which is something he mentions a few paragraphs later in that passage you read. My mother told me that he felt that was going a step too far. It was not something he particularly wished to remember.
He was 34 years old when he got on board the Titanic.
That's right.
And how much of it is your story? I'm talking to you about it today.
Well, I feel I'm more as a bystander. It was his story. I mean, he didn't stay in the U.S. He went back to England where my mother was born and where I was born. So it's just by coincidence that he landed in New York, where I'm working 100 years ago. So I've always felt a little detached from it. It was something that happened to him. It was a very big event in his life. And if he hadn't made that decision in those critical few moments, I wouldn't be here. But apart from that, it's Lawrence's story.
You write in the afterword to the book, "The Titanic keeps resurfacing to haunt our memories because its loss was a perfect monument to human folly." That's how you look at it.
Yes, well, it was. There were so many things that in retrospect seemed horrifyingly stupid about what was going on. And the ship was sailing through an iceberg field, of which the captain had been warned by telegram. It was sailing at full speed. It had no searchlights to spot icebergs, which are very hard to see in the dark. It was taking a risk that was judged to be much smaller than it was. I mean, they used to run those ships at full speed all the time, figuring that, well, you know, icebergs are very small and the ocean is very large, and the chance of hitting one is one in a million. Those, in fact, were the odds that the insurance company gave the ships at the time. But they had miscalculated the odds. They weren't one in a million. They were much greater, as the Titanic showed. But perhaps the other lesson is that It's not that sort of technology is bad. It's that technology is complicated, and you need always to learn from disasters and make things safe than before. So of course that's what happened. The loss of that Titanic led to many obvious regulations, you know, about carrying enough lifeboats and so forth, and sea travel became much safer.
The name of the book is Titanic First Accounts. It's a Penguin Classic original. It is edited and with an introduction by Tim Malton. Nicholas Wade is the grandson of Titanic survivor Lawrence Beasley, and he writes the afterword for the book. Nicholas, I thank you very much for being with us on this anniversary. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
Again, the title of the book is Titanic First Accounts. It's published by Penguin Classics. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.